nightmarish task of trying to coordinate all these people from different countries to write a book that is actually understandable but also interesting about a so-called trade agreement, Moomin Fee. And to thank our publisher and to thank all of you for your interest. The one thing I'll say is I hope everyone reads the book. And I'm not saying that just as an author, but because the book actually is a very useful way to understand what the agreement is really about and what the underlying debate is really about. Because I've noticed, not just in our country, but around the world, a lot of people haven't any concrete sense of what actually so-called trade agreements really are and what they mean. And the book is an accessible way to get there. I'm going to speak a little bit on the narrow front about what these agreements are, and then broadly a little bit about my great curiosity about why almost any country would want one of these U.S.-style free trade agreements, New Zealand particularly. The narrow piece of it is because most people have really no clue what these agreements are. And I might add that includes most members of the U.S. Congress. At the time originally of NAFTA, Ralph Nader, who founded our organization, made a bet that he would give $10,000 to the charity of choice of any member of our parliament who would simply sign an affidavit saying that he or she had read the actual text of the agreement and answered 5 simple questions. And no one would take the bet. And finally, 5 months later, these are people who are about to vote on an agreement that's going to lock us in indefinitely. 5 months later, a senator from Colorado, Republican, but this guy, Hank Brown, he's thinking, I'm going to make a horse's ass with Ralph Nader on national television. That creep, it's anti-trade, it's going to be wonderful, I'm a free trader. So he put the bets, and he came back after our Thanksgiving holiday, and he called his son, answered the question. We thought, oh, this is going to be ugly. Live on national television, we asked him the first question. He says, before I answer, I'm a very conservative guy, I'm a business guy, I'm a Republican, and I actually have voted for these agreements in the past, and I'm scared stiff because I didn't bother to read the other ones. This is not mainly about trade. I'm for trade. The U.S. has very few tariffs, like New Zealand, and very liberalized. We've already cut our tariffs autonomously or in other agreements. As well, we have a very open investment climate for foreign investors. Our services are largely privatized. Both of our countries are largely like that. And he said, now they've read this agreement. Who the hell wrote this thing? Because it's full of special protections for certain interests. It has new monopolies for patents. Why is that in a free trade agreement? I'm a libertarian. We don't like monopolies. And he went through the different parts of the agreement that he thought would never be at the top. And that is a key lesson, I guess, if nothing else strikes everyone when reading the book or why to read the book. These are called trade agreements, but they're not mainly about trade. It's a branding. It's a very clever U.S. marketing operation. Our trade agreements these days, the NAFTA agreement, which is the premise, North American Free Trade Agreement for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Negotiation, is like a delivery mechanism with an excellent brand of trade for a lot of other policies, a lot of which in our country failed in the sunshine of public debate. So what am I talking about? What would be, in all likelihood, in a Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement? Because the bottom line in this is, unfortunately, the U.S. is the Godzilla in this agreement. Negotiations stopped for 13 months when the U.S. decided they weren't sure what to do after Obama got elected. So if this was an agreement that wasn't all about the U.S. calling the shots, the rest of the party would have just said, all right, U.S., have a nice day, if you want to catch up to us later. But no, the whole thing ground to a halt. And that gives you a sense not just of the economic power dynamic, but of the reality. So what are our agreements like? I am very familiar with them and their outcomes. This is what you can foresee as a MP. This is the reality as compared to the rhetoric. These are the things that are in them. Number one, the key rule is, in all these agreements, signatory governments shall ensure the conformity of their domestic laws, regulations, and civil procedures. All of the agreements. And the agreements are typically 900 pages of rules and regulations, constraints on what governments are allowed to do. Countries shall ensure the conformity of all domestic laws, regulations, and administrative procedures with the attached agreement. This is like a super government over all of our constitutions. So, for instance, in our country, all of these extremely right-wing Tea Party people who got elected, they're against these agreements on sovereignty and democracy basis. They may even like the core agenda that's implemented, but the notion that you shall conform to this external agreement that glues you, cements you into any particular policy, I mean, from their vision, is probably global governance, socialism. They want a way out. But either way, I mean, as if that's what the agreements were, they didn't want to see something locking in. So what we have is an agreement that is binding, enforceable in separate tribunals that can impose sanctions. This is the only global governance that's actually enforceable. And in the case of some of the rules, privately enforceable. So what are these rules? One set of rules that has nothing to do with trade is new rights and privileges for foreign investors. This is the crux of these agreements. These agreements, more than anything, are about and were designed to be for U.S. corporate interests who want control of natural resources, land, telecommunications, financial services, transportation, procurement money for construction and infrastructure in other countries. It's new sets of rights for them. And it sets up a guaranteed minimum standard of treatment that every foreign government must give them. It applies to a vast set of so-called investments, including things like concessions for natural resources from your government, which suddenly become protected foreign investments under the agreements. The absolute right to acquire land and to use it in ways that aren't regulated, even under non-discriminatory domestic laws. As well, the agreements have private enforcement of those extraordinary investor rights. Now, if these are trade agreements that are about trade, about getting rid of border taxes, tariffs, or limiting quotas, removing quotas, limits and imports, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't spend years working on them. But the notion that you would have a trade agreement, the good name of trade, hijacked to implement a set of special rights and privileges that basically put governments at a disadvantage in regulating operations and activities in their own countries, because these agreements are privately enforceable by the actual foreign investor, not in domestic courts, but by signing one of these U.S. agreements, New Zealand would agree to go to the World Bank or to the United Nations to be sued by foreign investors to pay out of your treasury a foreign investor for the cost either of a regulatory compliance or for violating this guaranteed superior minimum standard of treatment. Now, this is perhaps the most egregious part of these agreements. It has led to a horrible set of challenges under NAFTA. The 66 domestic laws have been challenged, a bunch of them successfully. The three NAFTA governments have paid over $400 million to foreign investors, cash, treasury, to foreign investors, in cases that aren't about domestic law, that aren't in domestic courts, but that are foreign tribunals deciding that foreign corporations don't have to meet our domestic laws. And the cases are gruesome. One of them, for instance, is a U.S. Company that bought a toxic waste dump in Mexico. The dump had been closed. The Mexican owners had contaminated groundwater. And the sale was what we call a brownfield, where you get a contract that says, this is as is. No operating license. We have no liability. It's incredibly cheap, because it's going to cost you $3 million to clean it up, and then you can try and run it. The U.S. company bought it, and regularly they applied for permits. And theoretically, you know, they should be treated the same as a Mexican firm, except they were NAFTA investors. And so they right away, when they didn't get the permit, because the government, of course, said, listen, we told the previous owner, we'll tell you, you got to clean it up. They said, we're NAFTA investors. You either have to allow us to operate, or you can't. And they took it to the World Bank. And the Mexican government's strapped environmental agency paid $17 million in damages for denying foreign investor rights. And that is the beginning. Since then, there have been successful claims against bans of toxic chemicals, transboundary waste transport, forestry regulations. We've even now had a case where the entire U.S. tobacco settlement, the health settlement, and plain packaging, et cetera, is being challenged for $500 million. That's a pending case right now. We've had court rulings signed. I mean, the cases, and I, by the way, no one ever believes when I talk about this being U.S. agreements and how dangerous it is. So we actually have done a chart of all 66 cases, their actual legal names, the filing, the case numbers, what's happened to them. It's in our website, which is tradewatch.org, but I also have some printed out copies. That cannot be an agreement of the 21st century. But that is actually what, sadly, my country is still pushing. And it's not from lack of fighting against it, I might add. Now, there is one hopeful twist to this. Australia is the only country of the 17 with whom the U.S. has free trade agreements who just said, forget this, we are not doing that. That's ridiculous. We're two developed countries with operating court systems and perfectly good property protections. Why the hell would we allow a trade agreement to elevate one company to equal status with our entire sovereign nation? Why should nations who enforce agreements suddenly have the same stature as one particular company? Because, for instance, if I decide to put up a currency control because I'm having a crisis, and you're another country, you're probably not going to go after me, even though, ladies and gentlemen, that would violate the financial services regulatory constraints. But you won't go after me, because in 2 years you may have a crisis and you want to do it too. You have a diplomatic long-term thought. But if you're a private company and you're thinking for the quarter and you're a bank, screw you. You're going to get the money out. You're going to actually go after the government. You're not thinking that way. Private enforcement of public treaty rights is incredibly dangerous. One of the things that has to be a line in the sand, no future agreement can have that, but that's where we're heading. Also in these agreements, limits on service sector regulation. All kinds of limits. For financial services, limits on you can't regulate based on size. A ban on needs tests, both for financial and other services, so hospitals typically needs tested. These are in the terms, these are written down as market access rules. If you ever want to look at one of these agreements, pull up the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement. You can get on the trade representative USTR.gov website in the U.S. and look at Chapter 10. And it lays out all kinds of non-discriminatory treating foreign and domestic companies the same, just simply you can't regulate that way on services, including foreign services operating in your country. So there's a whole set of bad outcomes on that. But to me, one of the most pernicious in financial services is the European Union, the European Commission staff has written a paper basically saying that Germany and France's attempts to do a financial transaction tax, to slow down hot money, slow down capital flows, is a violation of those trade agreement rules limiting financial regulation. That's not me. I happen to agree with them. I've read the same rules. That's the actual European Commission staff has come to that conclusion. Those are the rules that are in the draft, because there are draft tests in investment and financial services for the TPP. That was started in 2008, post-financial crisis. As we can tell, no one knows it's a secret, that's still the language. That cannot be in an agreement of the 21st century after this crisis that we're not allowed to regulate financial services. Other areas and services have to do with size. For instance, big box stores. If you want to see something vaguely scary, look again at that trade website of our trade representative and search for Walmart. They've been very active in TPP, laying out how they're going to use the service sector market access rules to make sure there are no local land use limits and where they can go and how big they can be. And by the way, that's not just a free trade agreement agenda with them. They've been pushing that with WTO. We have a lot of FOIA documents. Go to our website and look at a store called Big Box Backlash, where we go through all the trade agreement rules after liberating some of these Walmart filings. Then there's the issue of meds. Bizarrely, these free trade agreements establish new monopoly paths for pharmaceuticals. This is another of these cases of things that can't get done, democracy get done. For literally several decades, the consumer groups like ours fought against our big pharmaceutical companies who wanted to expand the length of the monopolies they had in drug patents, so they could charge any price. So it used to be 17 years in the U.S. They've been trying to get 20, 25. We beat them, we beat them, we beat them. Because basically, it's really kind of hard to, you know, publicly announce you're going to jack up prices for Grandis pharmaceuticals when already we pay more than anyone else in the world. They suck into the trade agreements of pharmaceutical companies a 20-year monopoly pact, and we have to conform all domestic laws, regulations, and civil procedures. So we now have a 20-year pact. It costs us $6 billion in increased medical fees, drug prices, just for the things that were under patent when this went into effect. But that's not enough, because now the agreements actually also forbid access to the data that's necessary to make generic drugs. And our pharmaceutical industry has effectively gotten 30 years of monopoly because first you have the patents, and then for 10 years you can't get the data that you need to be able to actually show that you can make a generic. Now, what the hell is that doing in a free trade agreement? I have this vision of the philosophers of free trade, Adam Smith and David Ricardo, rolling in their graves to see these chapters setting up 30-year monopolies. I mean, this is why people like people in our U.S. Congress who are libertarians, like the guy who ran for Ron Paul, that sort of funny little man from Texas you occasionally saw on TV, he's against these agreements. Because from his perspective, it's, you know, ridiculous. A monopoly in a free trade agreement? These things should have three pages, which says, no nothing, no tariffs, no quotas, no nothing. Signed, there you go, free trade. In these agreements are also limits on how you spend your tax dollars. These are procurement constraints. And I know that Buy New Zealand isn't a big thing. Something to think about. In the U.S., we traditionally have, as have most developing countries, and the TPP has a lot of developing countries potentially in it, the use of procurement policy to recycle local revenue back into communities to actually create jobs and to create initiatives. For instance, now a lot of countries are using this for green investment. Under these trade agreements, you are forbidden from giving domestic and local preferences. So we have about 20 Democratic members of the House of Representatives who are out of Congress. Because we, when we did our big stimulus bill, couldn't give domestic preferences for certain things. And they all got attacked in paid television ads for shipping U.S. tax dollars overseas to create jobs there. Of course, they got attacked by Republicans who voted for the Republicans that forbid you from having any preferences for domestic procurement. But it's something to think about. Because to the extent, for instance, you want to diversify from what is mainly an extractive natural resources or agricultural products industry export platform here, and you want to use your government money to invest in creating some of these new industries, those are limits. And then the final piece is what is called in trade agreement D, sanitary and phytosanitary standards. That has to do with quarantine, food inspection. Anyone who's been to the U.S. lately will notice if you're in our Midwest, we have no maple trees left. We also have very little maple syrup, just way up north where it's very cold. They were wiped out by an invasive species called the Asian longhorn beetle. That's a critter that came in on wood pallets. Thanks to our trade agreements, we were not allowed to forbid either wood pallets or untreated ones from certain countries. And so you would say, oh, as long as you just simply can't have these pallets, it's not sticking it to any particular country, but it's a known invasive species, you've got to keep it out or you lose your home. But how is that a violation? Under these trade agreements, threatened of sanctions, and unfortunately, even a country as big as the U.S., our government backed down in the face of not wanting one of these cases. All of that then sums up the narrow view, the wide view, to close. The politics of these issues in the U.S. have gotten incredibly volatile. In the U.S., after 15 years of living with that trade agreement model, and by the way, we've had other really bad outcomes economically. We've seen our real median wages down to 1972 levels. We've lost 43,000 manufacturing facilities. Some of the people who only manage those, all those Republicans have started to get upset about these trade agreements. We, bizarrely, as one of the world's largest food exporters, in certain years became a net importer because the way the subsidy rules are gamed, depending on how the food trading companies decide to move commodities, even though we were exporting more than anyone else, we became a net importer in certain years because it was useful to dump in our market to gain the prices, which, as you can imagine, has unbelievable domestic implications. And as a big food exporter, you guys should think about that too. The politics in our country now, the lived experience is such that the only thing most Americans agree on across our country, Democrats and Republicans, all the way up to 120,000 income, which is four demographics, four levels of income demographics, all agree that current trade agreements, this model that dreadfully could be exploited through TPP, have been bad for their families economically and bad for the country. So we had 240 paid television in the midterm election run by Democrats and Republicans attacking NAFTA, CAFTA, and the bloke who voted for them. So in our country, it's become a little bit the kiss of death. And so the politics of TPP, as well as this Korea agreement that is bizarre that we're going to get announced soon, is somewhat like the leadership of the Republican Party, some of the folks in the White House who are left over from recycled from the Clinton era who were in favor of these agreements in the first place, pushing more of the same agreements and against most of the Democrats in Congress, plus a huge chunk of Republicans and increasingly the small business community. And so these last agreements that have been like this have passed by one or two votes. So with the TPP, I'm sad to report, I suspect it could end up being the worst of both worlds. In that, before this last election, we had come to a point where there was actually a real debate in our country about what model of trade agreements. I mean, everyone wants more trade. No one has a problem with trade. The question is, what are the terms And what else is attached to it? So if there is some benefit, but the cost of it's a poison pill of all this other stuff, you know, do you take that? And by the way, if New Zealand and the U.S. have a very liberalized trade, that's the upside. What is the trade? And so the bad news is, because of this Republican tsunami, we're not going to have what was a new sort of trade model that was being developed with 150 congressional co-sponsors of the legislation to replace the old NAFTA model. It's still very pro-trade, with different rules. What you will see probably is the leadership from the Republicans pushing all of those things that were in NAFTA as telling Obama, it's our way or the highway. It's either going to be the old model or, you know, we're going to, we're not even going to pass that. But then second, of the 80 new Republicans who are coming in, 40 of them are Tea Party guys. And these guys are classic mercantilists. If they're not altogether protectionist isolationists, so their vision is, let's use our trade agreements to put new rules for our guys to have new rights over there. But let's not have any more stuff come in here. And actually, ironically, the Democrats who got knocked out were much more free trade than a bunch of these freshman Republicans. So the bottom line of this is, in sort of, there are all these threats for downsides. The one upside, theoretically, I would suspect for New Zealand you're thinking about is more dairy access. And I can almost guarantee you had sort of the chances of getting real dairy access under TP were sort of slim to none before the election. And with this election, slim left out. Basically, I would give it like 5%. Because you have all these Republicans who came in, a lot of them from rural dairy districts, who just on a very concrete, oh my God, I have to stand election in 2 years, we keep switching the entire party, Democrat, Republican, every 2 years. I'm not going to be the guy who stands up for another NAFTA-style agreement, much less one that gives away the farm, literally. So on the upsides, it really is a question I keep asking this poor Jane, like, what does New Zealand think is the upside of this for you guys? What the hell could be the upside of this? What is the upside of this? Why are you in this? And then you see all the potential downsides. Because where I'll just close is, the biggest picture is, both of our countries are in a situation where we basically signed up for the big neoliberal experiments in our countries. And we went whole hog on trade liberalization, investment liberalization, privatization, deregulation. And we have now facing us a lot of very serious challenges. Some of the things we did work, but a lot didn't work very well. So if there have ever been countries that need to preserve policy space, to think of creative new things we can do to face the challenges of our future, the U.S. and New Zealand are right up there on the top of the list. But instead, this agreement poses to effectively sort of pour cement around our collective national feet. And sort of instead of being the agreement for the 21st century, basically stick us back permanently into the 19th century, basically not give us any space to move. And again, for the upsides of it, as such liberalized trade countries, you know, we're not really going to be changing our trade policies. We're going to be taking on all these other limitations and constraints. So could there be a good TPP? Yes. Would I wish there could be one that would be very different rules? Yes. Are we heading there now? Very sadly, no. I think there's a lot of things that could help try and push for a new model. But that's not where we're heading. And I just, as someone who is in the belly of the beast, who's been pushing this model, wanted to warn about that. And think about what we need going forward as far as policy space and a new system to expand trade and integrate economies.